This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Today it's my great pleasure to welcome to UCLA our speaker, who's Dr. Nina Shore. She's the chair of the Department of Pediatrics and the William Ellinger Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. She's also pediatrician-in-chief of the Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong and professor in the Department of Neurology, Neurobiology, and Anatomy. Prior to Rochester, I knew her when she was the chief of the Division of Child Neurology in the Department of Pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and held the Carol Ann Kramer Endowed Chair in Pediatric Research there, while also serving as the director, or excuse me, the associate dean for medical student research. Dr. Shore received her MD from Cornell, PhD from Rockefeller University. She completed her pediatrics and child neurology residencies at Harvard, Children's Hospital of Boston, and the Longwood Area Neurology Program. She heads a research effort aimed at design and development of new strategies for treating tumors, including neuroblastoma and pheochromocytoma, and understanding the developmental mechanisms underlying neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Her research has continually been funded by the National Institutes of Health, among other agencies, since 1988. And she has authored 100-plus peer-reviewed articles, 13 book chapters, and so on. And she holds a U.S. patent. She has won various teaching awards and continues to mentor many, and holds leadership positions in many national organizations as a counselor of the Society for Pediatric Research, secretary-treasurer of the Child Neurology Society, member of the exec committees of the American Neurological Association, the American Pediatric Society, and the American Society for Pediatric Department Chairs, and a member of the Science Committee of the American Academy of Neurology. Of key to us is she's a member of the steering committee of the Pediatric Scientist Development Program. She's the editor of the Sormans Pediatric Neurology Principles and Practice and Nelson's Textbook of Pediatrics. She's currently the president of the Child Neurology Society. She must have done something great because she even served as a role model for her own children, two of them MD PhDs launching their careers. So the title of her talk today is The Child is Father of the Man, Developmental Neurobiology Meets Geriatrics. Dr. Shore.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Devaskar, and thanks to all of you for being here early this morning. It really has been such a privilege and a pleasure to be part of your inaugural Discovery Day symposium. Such a joy yesterday to see the exchange of ideas across disciplines, across level of expertise, and across departments. Really, really a model for the way science needs to get done and the way medicine needs to get served across the country, not just at UCLA. So when I think of Grand Rounds, I think of very, very diverse audiences. I think of audiences that include, again, people at very different levels of expertise and who come with very different primary activities. And so what I hope I can do for you today is really give you a sense much more of the journey that research takes us on and its relationship to the clinic, rather than just the destination and the results and the data. Because I think that that is something that all of us, whether we're physicians or scientists or both, all of us share this wonderful privilege of meeting people who are constantly, regardless of their level of expertise, educating us. It's interesting that Dr. Devaskar mentioned my children. I think were they up here, they would say that they educated me rather than that I educated them. And they would be right, although I probably would not admit it to their faces. So just for the record, I do not have anything to disclose. I wish I were that entrepreneurial. I think most of us who are physician scientists, and especially those of us who are in disciplines that straddle the fence between the adult counterpart and general pediatrics, like child neurology, feel that we have forged careers that are at the interface. And careers at the interface between disciplines or between types of endeavor are both among the most joyous careers and interesting careers, and also the most challenging. To me, there are really three things that you have to keep in mind, and this is particularly for the trainees in the audience. I think the hardest thing that we do as physician scientists is to balance the need for focus so that you establish an area of expertise that you take ownership and with which other people in your field identify you, and also so that when something unforeseen comes along, when a surprise result, when a negative result that you didn't expect comes along, to have the liberty to choose to study that, even though it's not in the straight and narrow path that you set out for yourself. And this balance of staying on the path and stopping every once in a while to smell the roses is the toughest decision making that we do. You really want to not take every tangent that comes along because you won't have an area of focus, and you don't want to focus so much that you miss that very unexpected, exciting result. And then the third point I think that's important is if anybody ever gets up at this podium and tells you that they did everything that they talk about alone, you will know henceforth that they are lying through their teeth. It really does take a village to accomplish anything that's worth accomplishing. And I will point out as we go along and at the end, the people that really allowed me the privilege of talking about this work today. So the driver for what it is that I'm going to begin talking about really was a clinical problem, a problem that I got introduced to as a medical student at Cornell. I did my neurology rotation and a big chunk of my medicine rotation at Sloan Kettering. And it became very clear to me as a medical student that there were some cancer problems that we could not solve either because we couldn't engineer therapies that were toxic enough to the tumor or because we couldn't engineer therapies that were non-toxic enough to normal tissue. And really what this relates to is an insufficient understanding of the difference between normal and cancer and the ability that grows out of that to potentially target cancer tissues and leave normal tissues unscathed. When I became a resident in pediatrics, I met a young boy who came into the emergency room because he had spastic diplegia of subacute onset. And the etiology of his problem turned out to be this, turned out to be this retrocardiac mass that grew right through the neuroforamina in the spinal cord and compressed his spinal cord. And this actually is a neuroblastoma. And the issue with neuroblastoma, even now, is that for patients with small, solitary, non-metastatic tumors, we do incredibly well. Surgery alone cures forevermore 98 or 99% of those patients of their tumor. But for the 65% of kids with neuroblastoma that have large, bulky tumors or metastatic disease at diagnosis, we almost do the inverse. Depending on who you read and what modalities they use, the cure rate is somewhere between 5 and 20%. And things like bone marrow transplant and peripheral stem cell transplant and so forth have perhaps converted what was a 5-year survival rate to an 8-year survival rate. But we have nowhere near cured this tumor. Well, I began thinking, really as a resident, about what it was that made this tumor so tough, and whether somebody who thought of these tumors as primitive nerve cells rather than as cancer cells might be able to contribute something to their therapy, or at least the understanding of what the difference was between normal and tumor. So why do we fail with chemotherapy? I think the answer is really no different for neuroblastoma than it is for any other cancer. We fail because of this double-edged sword that I talked about earlier, the fact that it's either too little toxicity to the tumor or too much toxicity to normal tissue. This is an anthropomorphism. They learn to evade therapy. Actually, our therapies select for the cells that know already how to evade the therapy that we're using. And while this is the origin of multi-agent and rotating agent chemotherapy, which certainly is more effective than single-agent chemotherapy, the tumor cells seem to have no end of strategies for evading even those multi-agent strategies that we use. The tumor can turn against the host, and certainly with neuroblastoma, sometimes you win the battle and you lose the war because of opsoclonus, myoclonus, as a result of a tumor that is completely cured and a residual paraneoplastic effect that takes its toll on the intellect and the motor system of the child. And truly, all of this boils down to the fact that often Mother Nature talks to us in a language that we just don't seem to understand. There is a rhyme or reason to this whole system. We didn't design it, and we don't yet understand it completely. And so over the last two or so decades, my laboratory colleagues and I have tried really to approach each of these problems in a different way. And I'm going to begin by telling you a little bit about one of the problems that I think brings a neurologist's approach to neuroblastoma. So to do this, I'm going to introduce two players. These are neurotrophin receptors, TrkA and P75. TrkA is a very high affinity receptor for nerve growth factor. It is specific to nerve growth factor, and it is thought of as the nurturing receptor in this whole equation. People think of TrkA as the neurotrophin receptor responsible for protecting nerve cells from destruction, from apoptosis, and also facilitating differentiation in nerve cells, in the central and peripheral nervous systems. It's a tyrosine kinase signaling receptor. And for a long time, it was thought that the other receptor, P75, was merely a co-receptor with TrkA, that in fact, all it did was bind to TrkA and enhance the affinity of TrkA for nerve growth factor. And then somebody discovered something very, very curious, and that was in cells that didn't make any TrkA, P75 still seemed to alter the function of the cell. And so lo and behold, P75 evolved a function of its own in our minds. And it was thought, again, for a very long time that P75 as a solitary receptor was the antithesis, the counterbalance to TrkA, that in fact it was a death receptor. It is, But as almost always is the case, the story is not even close to that simple. So our simplistic idea very early in the tenure of my laboratory was that if we could find out which, if any, of the neurotrophin receptors mediated chemoresistance, if in fact they were protecting cancer cells, just as in normal neural crest tissue they would protect the neurons from which these tumor cells come, then perhaps we could make a fake ligand that actually blocked the activity of that neurotrophin receptor and made the cells more susceptible to conventional chemotherapy. Like so many ideas, this was great on a piece of paper, a wonderful idea, and really didn't solve the problem. And I'll show you why in a moment. So we began by saying, what if we take neuroblastoma cells that we know only express P75, and we treated them with various chemotherapeutic agents, and we blocked P75 or knocked out P75 or used ligands that thwart the activity of P75 and said, what happens to the survival of those cells in the presence of chemotherapeutic agent? And the answer, as is often the case, is it depends. If we treated, these are neuroblastoma cells growing in a dish. We're looking at cell survival relative to survival without chemotherapeutic agent. And we're treating, in this case, with neocarcinostatin. We've done several other agents as well. We've used etoposide. We've used Cytoxan. The result is very much the same. Or we treat them with 6-hydroxydopamine, which we thought might be a good targeted chemotherapeutic agent for neuroblastoma. It's an oxygen radical generator that gains specific entrance to neuroblastoma cells because of their dopamine uptake system. And it is so polar that it doesn't get into the central nervous system at all. So you don't have to worry about brain dopamine receptors. And so we looked at cells that were P75 positive in the magenta and cells that were P75 negative in the blue. In the case of neocarcinostatin, having P75 present appeared to potentiate the death of these cells, so that in the P75 positive cells, cell survival after treatment with neocarcinostatin was far less than it was if the cells didn't have P75. So here P75 is a death receptor. On the other hand, if we treated these cells with hydroxydopamine, exactly the opposite happened. Having P75 positive enhanced survival of the cells in the face of this insult. And so here was one of these tangents. This was an unexpected result. We thought we had the panacea, and in fact, we needed more information before we could make this system work. And we were faced with the decision, my colleagues and I, of whether to drop this like a hot potato and do something else, or whether to ask if understanding the mechanism that determined whether this would be a death receptor or a protective receptor would help us design specific therapies for specific neuroblastomas. And we decided to give it a try for a few years to work out the mechanism of this. And in a nutshell, it matters where you are generating reactive oxygen species. So in the case of agents that generate either mitochondrial or nuclear reactive oxygen species, having P75 present potentiates cell death. And so many of the chemotherapeutic agents we were looking at were DNA cleaving agents because they generate these reactive oxygen species inside the nucleus. And in fact, we looked at fenretinide, a more recent addition to the neuroblastoma armamentarium, and fenretinide generates mitochondrial reactive oxygen species, and it too is potentiated by P75. On the other hand, if we generated cytoplasmic reactive oxygen species, having P75 present protected the cells from the toxicity. So here, in a way, was a mechanism for individualizing therapy based on the agent that you were planning to use. So P75 can be protective or death-inducing. It depends on, as I've shown you, the nature of the agent that you're using. We have other studies over the years that have said it depends on the host into which you're introducing this. It depends on the nature of the cell you're trying to kill. And so this really underscores the need for molecular individualization of therapy in cancer. So what we've learned from this is not what we set out to learn, and what we've developed is not what we set out to develop in the first place. And we never would have learned these things had we not taken the time to go off the beaten path for a little while. But clearly, targeted therapy of the future has to be aimed at molecular characteristics of the tumor, molecular interactions of the tumor with the host, and ultimately, as we understand more of this, molecular interactions of the tumor and the host with environmental factors, including the chemotherapy that we're choosing to use. As an example of one of the things we're doing now that takes advantage of this, almost all of the familial neuroblastomas that have been identified and 10 or 11% of sporadic neuroblastomas are made more virulent, if you will, more difficult to treat as a result of a mutation in the protein ALK. ALK is an enzyme. Clearly, that mutation must make something else happen downstream of the ALK itself in the pathway in which it acts. And what Xinguo Li in my lab has discovered recently is that in the case of normal ALK, non-mutated ALK, a certain amount of a transcription factor called 6-3 is made. And 6-3, both directly and through indirect mechanisms, appears to regulate cell survival and cell replication, entry into the cell cycle, and resistance to disruption of the cell cycle. On the other hand, if you mutate ALK, and we've looked at all of the prevalent, there are three or four prevalent mutations of ALK in the familial groups of neuroblastomas. All of those mutations result in overproduction of 6-3. And overproduction of 6-3 results in very abnormal rates of replication of neuroblastoma cells and cell survival. And our hope is that this pathway that goes both from ALK to 6-3 and from 6-3 to these effects on cell survival might provide new targets for the therapy of neuroblastoma. But this is predicated, using this therapeutically is predicated on the notion that you know whether a given patient's tumor expresses a mutant ALK. Again, individualization, molecular identification of the targets in a particular subject with a particular tumor. So the equation turned out to be much more complex than we originally thought. One of the things that we began thinking about as we were exploring these new targets for therapy was maybe what we knew about P75 would be better put to therapeutic use if the system was more stable. I mean, there is no greater system for repeated mutation and modification of a substrate than cancer. But there are normal systems that are much more stable because replication and the potential for mutation is not as robust. And for me as a neurologist, the central nervous system provides that substrate. Even the neurons that are replicating that we just recently have discovered as stem cells don't have anywhere near the rate of replication and mutation that a cancer cell does. And so we began to wonder if P75 might be of relevance in that situation. Just as we were starting to think about that, serendipity reared its head again in this equation. In the person of a postdoctoral fellow at that time, who's now an assistant professor at Vanderbilt, this is Zelka Karati. And Zelka Karati had done her PhD where I was at the time at the University of Pittsburgh, and I had been on her thesis committee. And I knew her to be a very energetic, very creative scientist, and a very easy person with whom to work. And so when she approached me as she was finishing a postdoctoral fellowship, also in Pittsburgh, and said, "Can I do a second postdoc in your laboratory?" I was absolutely delighted. I said yes without any other information because I already knew her and I already knew I would love to work with her. And she looked at me and said, "Don't say yes so quickly. Let me tell you what I want to do, because I'm not so sure you want me to do this in your lab." I thought that was a little odd. It was not in keeping with what I knew of her personality, but we were friends, so I said, "Okay, go ahead, make your case." And she said, "Well, what I really, really want to do is I want to work on Alzheimer's disease." And I thought, why on earth, if you want to work on Alzheimer's disease, would you approach a pediatric neurologist? That is the weirdest thing I have ever heard. So she said, "Hear me out, because I think the methods and the things that you are currently studying are of relevance for what I want to do." She said, "You know, first of all, you've been studying chemotherapeutic agents and protective mechanisms that relate to oxidant stress. And oxidant stress is of importance in a lot of neurodegenerative disorders at any age. And so I think the mechanisms you're looking at, I mean, what does it matter if you want to prevent the protection to make cells susceptible to cell kill? And I want to enhance the protective mechanisms to protect the cells. We're looking at the same processes." And I thought, well, okay, that's a start. But, you know, honestly, these days there almost isn't anything that you can't implicate reactive oxygen species in. And I'm not so sure we're right about all of those things. So I wasn't convinced yet. The next thing she said is that, really, the molecule that you're looking at, P75, in the central nervous system is a developmentally regulated molecule. And this is not our work. This is work that many others had done over the years. In the embryo, it is ubiquitously expressed in the brain. And as an organism ages, it gets successively more and more restricted in its expression. And what you're left with as you enter adulthood is expression of P75 uniquely in the nucleus basalis of Meynert, in cholinergic neurons in the hippocampus, and cholinergic neurons in the cerebellum. And what's important about this, or at least what was important to Dr. Karati at the time, was that all of these loci have been implicated in the pathogenesis of Alzheimer's disease, particularly the nucleus basalis of Meynert and the hippocampus. Well, okay, this was better. I started to listen. And then she told me something that was incredible to me, and that was that P75 is really a pro-protein. It is not active by itself. It's a receptor. It sits in the membrane. It binds a ligand, and there are several cognate ligands for P75. And it is a transmembrane protein, and the binding of the ligand results in its cleavage, and it's the intracellular piece that then goes off to the nucleus as a transcription factor that is the business end of this molecule. We knew that. But what Zelka knew that I was unaware of at the time was that the enzyme that cleaves it is a gamma secretase. And in fact, presenilin, the molecule that is mutated in familial Alzheimer's disease, is a gamma secretase and is a very, very active central nervous system cleaver of P75. So here we had a molecule that I had been working on in a completely different context that turns out to be uniquely expressed in adulthood in places where this degenerative disease is thought to have its origins and is cleaved by the enzyme that's mutated in this disorder. This was enough to convince me that perhaps my pediatric neurology laboratory ought to start working on Alzheimer's disease. It did not immediately convince my colleagues to whom I brought this proposal, but that is a whole other human interest story. So we agreed, Zelka and I, that we would start doing a few experiments together while she was still working in her previous lab. And the first experiment we did was to say all of this protection that P75 can do from reactive oxygen species in the cytoplasm, if we're right that cleavage by presenilin is important in this process, then all you should need to protect the cells is the intracellular domain. The outside should be immaterial. All it does is set up this molecule for cleavage. And so we asked, if you had P75 negative cells that have a very low percent survival when you treat them with reactive oxygen species, could they be engineered to behave like P75 positive cells if all you did was put in them an expression construct just for this little intracellular piece of P75? And indeed, that's exactly what we found. We took two different size pieces of P75, the intracellular domain and the intracellular domain plus the transmembrane little fragment, and both of those restored protection to these P75 negative cells. We then did an experiment that involved people in my laboratory taking P75 positive neuroblastoma cells and P75 negative neuroblastoma cells, the cells we had done our early experiments on, and saying, what's different in the transcriptome of these cells? What's different in protein expression? What happens to the cell when you take P75 out of it? And on the other hand, Zelka took wild-type presenilin mice, and she took mutated presenilin mice. When I think about this, honestly, it's amazing to me that it worked as well as it did. She took whole hippocampus and ground it up and said, what's different in the whole hippocampus protein expression profile between wild type and mutated presenilin? And then we asked, is there a set of proteins that's different in the same direction and in the same way when you take P75 out as when you mutate presenilin? Because if we were postulating that this mutated presenilin did what it did through some abnormality of P75, there should be a big overlap between these sets of changes in the cell. And in fact, to our great surprise, it was very interesting, and this in itself is an example of how intensely social science is, much to the opposite of what the public thinks of science. There's Zelka in her lab doing the presenilin study. There's my postdoc, Xiaohua Yan, doing the P75 study. And they come together only to have a lab meeting. They do not talk to each other while they're doing these studies. They didn't want to bias each other. They didn't want to jeopardize the purity of the results. And they come to lab meeting and plunk down on the table their most changed proteins. And the lists are superimposable, absolutely superimposable. And the other surprise in this was that the absolutely most changed proteins in both sets were four proteins that comprise much of the cholesterol biosynthetic pathway. Now, I could not, this is, believe me, 1996, before ApoE was an important thing in the world of Alzheimer's disease. This was absolutely a surprise result. And it was a surprise result that we had to put to the test, because anybody who does microarrays knows it's a screening test. It's very much like doing newborn screening in the clinic. Once you identify an abnormality, you bring that child back and actually measure the enzyme. It's the same thing when you do microarrays. You want to actually validate everything that you do. And so one of the things we did for validation is we said, if cholesterol synthesis is important for this protection from reactive oxygen species, then we should get rid of it if we put a statin in these cell cultures. And that is, in fact, exactly what happens. P75 negative cells exposed to reactive oxygen species, you drive the cell count down because they succumb. P75 positive, they are protected to some extent. P75 positive cells treated with mevastatin behave as if there is no P75 present. And so we began to think that we could perhaps treat Alzheimer's patients with some fragment of the intracellular domain. And Aliyah Kazi and Mark Halterman in my lab actually have been looking at how small can you make this peptide. The smaller you can make it, the more likely it will be a druggable molecule. How small can you make it and still get this protective effect? And those studies are currently ongoing. But the hope would be that we could someday do gene therapy and put an intracellular domain expression construct into exactly the right cells in exactly the right place in the brain of a patient with Alzheimer's disease. This is science fiction right now. This isn't ready for prime time. The technology clearly is not ready for first-in-man studies and is even not easy to do in animal studies. But this concept was very, very intriguing to us. The question was, what could we do while we were waiting for this to grow up and happen? And again, serendipity stepped in this. Right about this time, I had been in Pittsburgh for 20 years. I had been thinking that perhaps I could take what I learned being a chief in child neurology, that I could take all of those lessons and apply them to a broader platform. And I began to think about chair positions with some trepidation, honestly. I wasn't sure I was ready to be pulled out of the lab as much as would be required. On the other hand, what I did do in the lab would be informed by a much broader array of input. And there's always a yin and a yang in everything that you do in life. But I long story short, ultimately made the decision to move to Rochester. The University of Rochester has really a renowned neuroscience and neurology community. I thought very naively, as it turns out, that I would just plunk what I used to do in Pittsburgh into Rochester space and have all the same kind of collaborators around me. And that was not at all the case. But what I did have was collaborators that thought about very different things than I had ever thought about. So I met this new set of friends. And this new set of friends, this picture actually is of the first class of our Project Search initiative. These are individuals, most of whom are in the autism spectrum, and they are young adults who we have a program, and there are several of these around the country, where we actually train them for jobs in the marketplace. And they're not the traditional. It is funny. When we talked with people in our community who work with children and young adults with autism, they said, please don't put all of them in the food service. Everybody puts them in the cafeteria. And that these guys do anything but that. They are truly, truly remarkable individuals with teachers that are twice as remarkable as they are. But this very large group of people in my department who work clinically with kids and young adults with autism spectrum disorders is matched on our undergraduate campus, our River campus. And much like you, we have everything on a contiguous campus. So the individuals in brain and cognitive sciences on our River campus actually work on autism from a basic science standpoint. So this was the perfect synergy for them. And I began to wonder if I could have a piece of the action. I have to say that there is always a danger when you come in with your set of tools and your favorite molecule and you want to apply it to something new. There's a saying that if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So I will throw that caution out there. But I began to think about P75 as a mediator of autism. And I'll show you why. So in this audience, I probably don't have to tell you about autism. Suffice it to say, it is a common disorder, a disorder characterized by inappropriate social interaction, sparse social interaction, difficulty reading social cues, and stereotyped repetitive behaviors. There appears to be an inflection point somewhere around 2 to 3 years of age when the manifestations at least become more apparent, more obvious. We used to think that there was regression, that it wasn't there until 2 to 3 years of age and that suddenly it appears. I think the going thought now is that there are signs of this disorder even in infancy, although that is not universally held as a tenet. But something, everyone I think agrees that something happens around 2 to 3 years of age in the manifestations, and it is associated with some known genetic syndromes. So I began thinking about P75 as an autism mediator. In a way, jokingly at the beginning, again, I thought, yeah, wouldn't that be a kicker? I mean, here I am, I work on P75, and everybody in my department's working on autism, and now all of a sudden P75 is the molecule of the year. But as I thought more and more about it, I realized that this is a molecule that is developmentally regulated, that has an inflection point in its expression in humans between 2 and 3 years of age. It is present in by late childhood and early adulthood in anatomic locations that are implicated in autism, just as they're implicated in Alzheimer's disease, particularly the cerebellum and the hippocampus. It plays a role in modulation of redox state, and you've already seen some of those data. and from the work of others in inflammation, both processes that have been implicated in autism. And maybe most convincing, one of its cognate ligands is BDNF, and another is pro-NGF. And both of these molecules, aberrations of their expression and function, have also been implicated in autism. So I decided, again, it was a big tangent for us. My lab had never worked on mouse models of behavior before. But I decided that we would spend a little time looking at whether there was any possibility that P75 contributed in some way to the pathogenesis or the manifestations of autism. And so what we did was to obtain a conditional knockout mouse for P75. And this in itself was fortuitous. P75 there are many, many, many alternative splice variants of P75, all located on the same chromosome in juxtaposition to one another. And some of them are functional and some of them are non-functional. And there have been several putative knockout mice that really weren't knockout mice because the alternative splice variant took over the function. And right about the time we were thinking about this, Vesa Karttinen at the University of Michigan made a true conditional knockout. He flanked the entirety of these alternative splice sites, it's a most of chromosome 17, with LOXP sites. And then you can engineer Cre, the enzyme that cleaves the genome at those LOXP sites. You can engineer it so it's only expressed in certain cells or certain tissues. So you functionally knock out P75 only in certain places. And so what we did was to cross this mouse with a Cre, the enzyme, which is only expressed in Purkinje cells in the cerebellum. So we made a mouse that had P75 knocked out only in the Purkinje cells of the cerebellum. And we asked, what did its behavior look like? First, we looked at social behavior, because if, in fact, these mice were not socially autistic, the ball game was over. And in fact, what we noticed was if we put another mouse in with our mouse, a stranger mouse, our knockout mice did much less grooming and exploring and social investigation of that stranger mouse. They appeared not to be interested, to be honest. They did much less in the way of fighting behavior, boxing behavior with the stranger mouse. They did much less banging in sideways to this mouse. They just seemed not to care whether the mouse was present or not. Now, mice explore things by olfaction, and so we had to be sure that these mice had an intact sense of smell. And in fact, they clearly are able to smell. They approach food the same way. They approach things, odorants that you put in the cage, exactly the same way that a normal mouse would. And then we asked whether the motor behavior was different, because if the mice can't walk around, and after all, we engineered the cerebellum, and we think of the cerebellum, again, naively, I think, as a motor center. It is a whole lot more than that. But suffice it to say that these mice do rotarod normally. They walk normally. They walk for normal amounts of time. They keep their balance normally. What they do motorically that's very interesting is they jump in a seemingly purposeless way. Now, obviously, you can ask how I know that the mouse doesn't have a purpose, and it's, you know, obviously I don't. But this is the equivalent, I am told by my mouse behavior experts, of an automatism. These mice do this very funny automatic jumping. And normal mice and mice that have Cre only without the LOXP sites, they jump too, but not nearly as much and not nearly as often. So, again, as a motor activity, sniffing and grooming is a way of exploring the environment for mice, and these mice do much less of that. When we looked at the expression of P75, we had to make sure it was knocked out in these mice. And although our constructs are not fully penetrant, about 50% of the cells in the Purkinje cell layer of these Cre-LOX mice do not express detectable P75, whereas in wild type, every cell is filled with P75. So we think we have at least knocked out a substantial fraction of the P75 in the cerebellum. And then we looked at the neuroanatomy of these cerebella. And I have to say, they are not exactly the same as what you see in autistic humans. In autistic humans, the Purkinje cell layer is much thinner than in normal humans. And we don't see a difference in the thickness of the Purkinje cell layer, but what we do see is a drastic decrease by any measure you use, whether you measure perpendicular neurites or neurites in the plane of section, whether you measure the number of short neurites that come off of a longer neurite. By any measure, the knockout mice have a much less complex dendritic arborization of those Purkinje cells than the normal or the Cre-LOX or the Cre-only mice. And so we think we have made a model that at some level, but not exactly, approximates autism. So is P75 a molecule that has something to do with human autism? I mean, we get all of these kinds of behaviors that mimic autism. We get stereotypic movements and a neuroanatomy that has some of, but not all of the features of autism. I don't think at this point that we can actually say that this is implicated in human autism. And my colleagues in genetics at the University of Rochester are actually looking in their screens now. They have added P75 to their screening studies. And I think the jury is out at this point. Well, why do we care? It seems to me that in some ways P75 could tie together some of the loose ends in the autism story. It could tie together the neuroanatomy and the behavior and the relationship to aberrant BDNF expression. In so doing, it seems to me it could uncover potential targets for therapy. If P75 functions as an antioxidant in the central nervous system and is functionally or anatomically knocked out in autism, then perhaps antioxidants are the way to go. But do you put them into the mitochondria or into the cytoplasm or into the nucleus? And to me, the biggest issue relative to the cholesterogenic story is, what is the timing of this? We're not talking about metabolic cholesterol in atherosclerotic individuals. We're talking about central nervous system, de novo synthesis, and we have some recent studies that make me think that it isn't cholesterol that matters. It is the intermediates in the cholesterol pathway that farnesylate P75. So even if we knew that these were potential therapeutic targets, we have a long way to go to work out how and when and in what way and to what cells to deliver it. But we are now on a journey that, honestly, 20 years ago, I would never have predicted that I would have been on. And so I always feel like the process And the journey is much more important than the destination, because we learn something even from the negative results that we generate in science. And what we learn, I think, informs what we do in the clinic, and what we see in the clinic informs how we interpret what we get in the lab. Now, I told you that it takes a village to do these kinds of things. And to me, the most important thing about this list is the diversity of the people with whom I have had the privilege of going on this journey. This includes high school students, college students, medical and graduate students, faculty colleagues, technicians who have often taught me more than I ever thought I could learn. And have really kept me on track, and funding agencies that I think people tend to be very gloom and doom, and perhaps with good reason, about funding. But I think you can see over the years we've gone through these cycles where funding is predominantly federal or predominantly foundation or predominantly philanthropy. I think you just have to apply the same creativity to obtaining funding that you apply to doing the studies in the laboratory. I don't feel negative. I feel like it's not bad, it's different. Maybe I'm an eternal optimist in this. But I thank you for your attention and really for the privilege of being part of your Discovery Symposium, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.